Okay, hello, welcome back to Millennial 2019. I am sorry that we're so late behind, but various logistical difficulties. Up next, I've got Red Ice, and that will see us through to Christmas Day. But for now, I am with Frode Midyard of Scanza Forum. So, Frode, welcome to Millennial.
Thank you, and woe unto he who keeps me waiting.
I am sorry. I have apologized already. It was just...
These things happen. Don't worry about it.
All right. So some people are very anxious to hear from you. So what kind of... I guess the first thing to say is, what kind of year have you had? Not speaking culturally and politically, but just about the last year for you.
Yeah, it's been a busy year. And I mean, it's been a busy decade, really. I mean, you want us to start just talking about the current year, so to speak.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I've spoken at 9 different conferences. I wrote it down actually, in 6 different countries. So, and the Scanza Forum, we've previously had 2 events per year. This year we've had 3 events, and it's been a very productive year. And I've also done Guide to Culture. I've also done a lot of other stuff. So it's been a very productive year for me, and I'm very happy with that. It started out in Estonia, Tallinn, Estonia, their conference in February, I think. That was a great conference. I gave a speech about political assertiveness, basically. Not being willing to be pushed around. And I think that's a big problem, because a lot of people are sort of assertive online and so on, but in their private lives, they are afraid to talk about their views to other people, even their family and so on. And I think that's a problem. So I gave a speech about that, and that was very well received, actually, in Tallinn, Estonia. And then we had the Scanza Forum in Stockholm, in March, and that was about anarcho-tyranny.
Yeah, that was a great conference. I was talking about it with somebody else last night, and Mark Collett, and because that was, I was there, and that was when I gave the Hope Not Hate speech, and Mark was there as well.
Yeah, that was a fantastic conference, and it was in Stockholm, and you gave your speech there exactly. Mark Collett was on for the first time. I'm very impressed with him. He got standing ovations. We had Olena Semeniaka, Greg Johnson, Martin Lichtmes, and then Jared Taylor. To prove our point, Jared Taylor was banned from entering Schengen. So he was stopped in Switzerland, turned away at the border because he was landing from America in Switzerland, was going to continue to Stockholm, and he was stopped there, detained, and thrown out of Europe with basically no justification at all. They didn't give any justification, but it definitely proved our point. It was very, it was a fitting conference about anarcho-tyranny because they...
Well, all 3 of the conferences that you've done this year, the ones that you've organized this year, have fallen foul of anarcho-tyranny in one way or another.
Definitely, yes, in many ways. You know, there's a term called anti-fragile, sort of pop cultural, pop sociological phrase that's around, you know. But basically, what it means is that you're anti-fragile if, when you're attacked, it doesn't hurt you, but it hurts your opponent. It hurts the person attacking you. Then you're anti-fragile in a way. I mean, well, that's one of the meanings of it, or one of the parts of the thing. And basically, we have become anti-fragile in many ways because that's a very positive development, because when our opponents try to attack us, they try desperately to attack us and try to prevent us from speaking, but it always blows up in their faces, which it did in the later conferences. Most definitely. But here they did stop Jared Taylor. They accused him of totalitarianism when they used totalitarianism against him. So he was stopped because he supported the totalitarian ideology. but of course, he was the victim of totalitarianism because he's in no position to exercise totalitarianism. So that sort of doesn't make any sense at all. No. So he's banned, and this is old news, but the Golden Wand took his place. So that was a successful event. That was a great event. We had lots of good people there. And then the week after, we went to Finland to the Awakening Conference. That was also very productive in many ways because I gave a speech there. I didn't really feel, you know, I was sort of stressed out of my mind. I had a lot of different things to think about. I wasn't very happy about my own speech. I wasn't happy about my own performance. But I think I talked about some valuable points. But, you know, when you give a speech, it's a lot about the energy. You know, it's like you want to present like the Jonathan Bowden energy, but you're not always able to do that. But still, the content I was very happy about. And it did result in some conversations afterwards. I talked with the Z-Man and Ramsey Paul. We had good conversations about what we talked about during that event. And I think that was the second Awakening Conference. We were both there.
Yes.
If I'm wrong. Yeah. So that was great. And then I went back to Sweden in the summer, first once, and spoke at a place called Svenskarnas Hus, the house of the Swedes. It's a community house. You know, there's a thing in Scandinavia, at least. I'm not as familiar with the rest of Europe, but, you know, all ethnic groups have a community house. So you have a community house for Somalis, you have a community house for Kurds, and all different kinds of ethnic groups. But Swedes aren't really supposed to congregate as Swedes, you know, as an ethnic group with ethnic interests, and congregate in a house, in a community house, for sort of getting together around their interests. But this group, this organization in Sweden has collected money, they bought a community house out in the countryside, and they had a conference there. And the conference was organized by Jonas Nilsson and a couple of other people who run Palaestra Media. And those people are really, really impressive because he did a documentary about South Africa called The Boer Project, I think the documentary is called. He did it at the same time as Lauren Southern made a documentary about South Africa. And it's a very impressive thing, and they have done a lot of video work, and they have a lot of conferences that they've organized and so on. So they invited me to speak there. I'm very grateful for that. And that was a very good conference. Then in late summer, early autumn, we both spoke in Manchester, right outside of Manchester, at the Patriotic Alternative, organized by Mark Collette. And that was also a very impressive conference because, you know, one of the things that I've talked to Mark about a whole lot is, you know, moving away from this is my issue, moving away from the sort of weird subcultural ghetto of our opinions or our talking points or our issues that we talk about, the problems we talk about, and not really having this ghettoized brand around our issues. Basically, you know, it's like when we have to talk about these things in a way that sort of it's a bit of, you know, sort of a forbidden thing, and it gives it a low status. But what he was able to do is he was able to gather a lot of high-quality people. It was a very sort of clean, nice-looking event that was very impressive and had a lot of good speakers, among them you and Ed Dutton, Hugh, who we both know, and so on. So that was a very good, positive thing, a positive thing in the development of nationalism in Britain, I would say.
Oh yeah, it was directly as Mark was saying last night. That conference was modelled on your Stockholm conference. That's the level of quality that he was going for.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Because I mean, he's been involved in nationalism for a long time. I've been involved in nationalism for a long time, and we both sort of know what to expect. And I guess, you know, that what he has seen over the years has sort of led him to expect just continuing with the same. But you know, with what I've tried to achieve you know, what we have at our events, he saw that, well, you can actually be a bit more picky about who you invite and, you know, what kind of a brand you want to create, not just accept anyone and just have a very subcultural thing. And I think he succeeded. I think it was a fantastic event, and I'm very impressed. I'm impressed by him, generally speaking. So that was very good. And then I went on two other conferences in Sweden, and it was in connected to the release of Greg Johnson's White Nationalist Manifesto, the translation in Swedish. And so there was, I gave one speech in Stockholm, one speech in Gothenburg, and that was great. We talked about a lot of the same issues that I talked about in Manchester or in the UK with principles of marketing, because that is really what my issues are in this whole thing. I mean, I don't think it needs a whole lot of. Well, I'm not gonna sort of. I'm not going to sort of belittle anything that sort of the intellectuals, the work the intellectuals do who talk about sort of the facts of the situation and demographics and the intellectual history of things and so on. But I think that the problems we see before us are rather obvious. And I think that a lot of people see them with their own eyes. And my personal passion and what I've studied since I became interested in these things over the last two decades, the things I've studied is how to actually do something about it, how to persuade people, how does psychology work, how does marketing work, what does actually influence people in how they think and how they talk and how they act. And those are the important issues that I wanted to talk about, and that's what I talked about in those conferences.
I think it's absolutely right and great that, yeah, first of all, we need good people in the movement, capable people, right. and then ideally capable, intelligent people who are not socially maladjusted. That'd be fantastic, and then we need them to be thinking about constructive solutions to the situation, and I think that's what we're getting now. Basically, I think it's great. Yeah. I think that previously. Nationalism was not dominated by socially maladjusted types, but there were a lot of them there, and they tended to be the most vocal, or at least the most obvious. I mean, the ones that our enemies would use to portray us, to depict us. So yes. I think that kind of thing, that era is really coming to a close, because I think we're finding our own voice, basically.
You know, there's a documentary about the black metal subculture and Satanist milieu in Scandinavia. The documentary is called Satan Rides the Media. And a friend of mine wrote an article about this, suggesting that the nationalist milieu followed some of the same patterns. And what the documentary says is basically that in the early 90s, when the black metal milieu came up in Norway, the media created a hype around it. And what happened was, you know, with the church burnings and all, and the media created such a hype around it that the media created the copycats and the media created the Satanist sort of movement in a way. And in the same way, sort of hostile media attention against nationalism and films like, you know, the sort of films that describe the subcultural milieu, definitely in the 90s, were things that, you know, nationalists, young nationalists, impressionable people, obviously, you know, because there's like a generational gap. So there was a huge subculture of young people in the 90s who were nationalists, but they didn't really have any good guidance. I mean, there are some exceptions. There are some people in the generation over that, but a lot of people who were teenagers and they were in their early 20s in the 90s, they didn't really have a lot of adult people to look up to and to follow and who could show them a positive way. So what they did was they watched a lot of these films and they emulated that. They emulated the negative portrayals made by their enemies, and they followed that example, and they created basically a need build is a Swedish. I'm trying to find a good English equivalent of need build, but it's like the worst stereotype of yourself. You're like you're confirming the enemy propaganda picture of yourself in a way. And a lot of people did that, unfortunately, I would say. But that did happen, and we have a lot less of that today. And that's a very good thing.
Yeah, I think that that's part of this, the movement of the alt-right and the distant right over the last 5 years, maybe longer than that, but definitely the last 5 years. The main thing that it's achieved, apart from that you could say various things that it achieved, but one of them was that it brought these ideas to a much wider range of people. Yeah. And it's not just... it's people who are often quite successful and accomplished in their own lives. So it's exactly what you would want, basically.
Yeah.
Go on.
No, I mean, this is just a development over the whole 2000s. I mean, maybe we're going to talk about the whole decade later, but I guess it's like in a normal conversation, we jump back and forth. So the thing is that, I mean, in the 90s and in the early 2000s, what you had was the written word. So you had on the other side, like in the liberal or leftist mass media, the message was conveyed in audiovisual content, presented in a very persuasive way, with TV, with cinema, with films, and everything. And what we had to counteract that was basically just the written word, and in mail order form. So you had to actively send cash somewhere and order a magazine, and that's what we could offer, basically. And that started changing in the early 2000s with the blogs, because all of a sudden you could actually it became a popular thing that people wrote more personal or like more easygoing thing. It wasn't like this very formal publication that you had to pull a lot of work into. People just published very quickly things, and it became a more popular phenomenon. You could communicate very quickly with people, and that changed a lot. But what really started changing things, I mean, a lot of people have speculated about what started changing. What gave nationalism such a boost? And that is that, you know, when our enemies try to paint us as bad people, they try to paint pictures of us as very bad people. And that is because they want to diminish our ethos, our credibility, our relatability as human beings. Because the reality of
this is what they always do. There was a photo of us all at the Accrington conference, and the thing that they said was, "Hope not hate," said that what a bunch of weirdos. And we didn't. Thing is, we didn't look like a bunch of weirdos, but they were stating that we did, because that was their mode of attack. They wanted their readers to think that we were a bunch of weirdos. Yes. I think that's fascinating.
Exactly. I mean, it never happens that they say, I disagree with nationalists because this, have you read this study? Have you seen these facts? Have you considered this point of view instead? This is why we need mass immigration. These are the arguments. These are the logical arguments. And these are the statistics. And these are the studies. And that never happens. I've never, ever, ever seen that happen. You know, I mean, maybe some attempts in that direction, but it's completely irrelevant in the big picture. What's relevant in the big picture is that they say that anyone who supports these notions that we should have, you know, ethnostates or whatever, that we should have our own countries, homelands, they are bad people. And they,
it's character. They don't go for arguing our points or our topics. They go for character assassination. They don't attack our arguments. They attack us as people. And I think it's disgusting, but they're doing it because it works, or at least it used to work for them.
Exactly, because it worked. And the thing is that up until the early 2000s, or the early 2010s almost, that did work because the picture they painted of us was the only thing that the people in general would encounter. We had arguments to put out, but that doesn't matter. We weren't human beings. We were just evil people in their eyes. And what changed dramatically was the appearance of podcasts, where people spoke with their own voices and they became human beings.
Yes, it humanized it all.
That others could relate to. And if you know, during your commute to work or whatever, you listen to a person day in and day out, and they just talk about normal things, and they happen to have certain political beliefs. Well, they become people. It becomes like people you know, because I've talked a lot about this in Guide to Culture, that the notion of hyper-reality, which is a term taken from postmodernism, which basically refers to the fact that our brains are not evolved to distinguish between real observations in the real world and audiovisual impressions from TV and so on. That is why we get emotionally impacted by what we see on TV. And, you know, if you go see a horror film, you get the fear response. That's why people watch horror films and so on. So, I mean, these things influence us emotionally. And what happens is, if you listen to a person, it sort of becomes a person that you know. And you can relate to them and identify with them. And that changed even more with the appearance of things like this, like YouTube videos, where you could actually see the people.
You see, oh, this is actually a human being like me. His, you know, he's not, if not normal, because I wouldn't ever venture to call myself normal. That would be putting it too far. But he is at least.
I don't strive to be normal.
Yeah, but he is relatable. He's not nuts, basically, which I think is a crucial thing, because that's what our enemies are desperate to paint us as.
Yes, I mean, but I usually simplify it as this, that before anyone ever listens to your arguments, if they even listen to your arguments, which very seldomly happens, arguments are, you know, in the hierarchy of what is relevant at all in persuading people or convincing people, logical arguments are at the lowest level. That's like the first rung on the ladder. But the top level is the fact that we are evolved to be social creatures. And, you know, William Pierce always said this, and it sounds trivial, that you know, that people function like lemmings in this sense, that when they hear something, when they hear someone suggests something that we should have, for example, we should have a homeland of our own. What the first thing they do is not consider, does this make sense? Does this seem morally justifiable? Are the facts presented by the other person true or false or so on? The first thing and the main thing that they consider is, what do the other people think? And especially, what do the high status people among the other, my peer group, think? That is the first thing. And for many people, the only thing they consider. And that is why social factor, the fact that we are herd animals, social animals, rather than exclusively rational animals, that is so crucial. And if you just... You know, even the most rational people are only rational when they sort of stop and focus on a particular thing, and they're rational in that limited period of time on that limited issue. The rest is just autopilot, everything going on in their mind and their emotions and so on. And it's mostly socially influenced. And that is why it was a complete game changer when we got these things like, you know, like YouTube and so on, where people can see the person. And they can sort of relate to him or her in some cases. And they can see that, well, this doesn't really seem like a very bad person. And the first thing they consider before making up their mind about, well, can I also share this opinion, is the person they're listening to. Is this a person I would like to, you know, have a beer with? Or is this a person I could introduce to my family or my coworker without being embarrassed?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Would associating with this person cost me socially, or would it be fine? If you compare it with what was there before, it was basically plain text on a piece of paper, a book, or latterly it was the blogs, but it's still only plain text. You've got no idea of the person, the personality, the nature behind those words. So podcasts suddenly bring it to the it's real, it's human beings. And then again with videos. Actually, I got it in reverse, but in a way, because for a year and 5 months, I was just talking to my fans. The first, when I started the channel, I was just talking to them via the comment section. And then in the May of 2015, I did Hangouts for the first time, and they were open to the public, so anyone could come in. And suddenly, I'd been reading people saying, saying that they liked my videos and all this kind of stuff for a year and 5 months. But suddenly I was confronted with real people, and it was the first, I'd never been to a conference. I'd never been to a social gathering in the movement or anything like that. So this was the first time I was actually realizing, oh my God, it's real people. It's actually, they've all got their own lives and their own personalities and things that they're interested in. And that was very strange. It was very heartwarming, obviously, and encouraging. And I think it, for the same reason, it affects people when they are able to see the person who has these ideas. It has that same effect. It's a human being, not just a thinking, calculating word producer.
Right. Exactly. And that is why the suggestion that the suggestion that I lost my train of thought here. That media is so important isn't really because of the information. You know, it's like the media says these or that, those things about statistics. It's because the media creates a sort of false sense of social pressure in a way, so that you see all the high status people that you see, they have these or those beliefs, but you can't really distinguish between those sort of the false peer pressure that you see on TV and the actual people you have around you. And that is why it's just so important to actually meet people. That's why I organize conferences. That's why I appear on these things together with you and other people. It's because it's important to just put a normal face. And it's not, you don't have to be, you have to be a genius. You have to be a fantastic person or anything. It's just you're a normal person that other people can relate to, and that other people can feel that they could be associated with, and they could introduce to their family or whoever without him being embarrassed. And I have to tell you, it's not about bragging or anything, but the point is that I have sort of convinced a lot of people throughout, the years I've been interested in this and involved in this, and made them comfortable talking about these things. And it has never been because I have been pushy or, been very sort of presented a lot of good arguments. It's happened mostly through osmosis. It's just that, I hang out with someone, they happen to know that I hold these beliefs. I never try to convince them about anything, but it's just that getting to know a person who, is fun to hang out with and who you can relate to, and who is just a person that you like to socialize with. And he happens, if it's okay for that person to hold these beliefs, or at least be honest with these beliefs, then maybe it's okay for me to do the same thing.
Yeah, I remember in your Stockholm conference last year, which I think was April 2018, we did the Q&A session, and somebody asked this question of how to persuade people. And it was, I don't think I'd thought about this question much, but I improvised an answer, and I wish it had been, I don't think it was caught on tape. Which is a shame, because I keep coming back to it in my head, because basically I said, one of the main things I said was, first of all, don't drown them with statistics, because most people, you are just going to drown them. That's all. And the other thing was, let them come to conclusions themselves. Don't force it on them and then get angry when they don't agree with you, and so on. Just sort of be more subtle and more human about it, basically.
Yeah. It's. I usually compare that to the safety belt on a car. You know, it's like if you try to really sort of pull it hard, it will just get stuck. It won't work. You have to pull it softly, and it's like you can't persuade anyone. You can't. You know, Dale Carnegie, he had this thing that he said that you can't win an argument. It's impossible to win an argument. Because when you try to push against someone, they will push back.
They become defensive. Yeah,
they'll become defensive. And no one wants to be proven wrong in a way. No one wants to sort of lose an argument and lose face. That's one of the most primal sort of drives in a human being is you don't want to embarrass yourself in front of the people around you, and that's completely natural and good and normal. And so like if you try to tell someone they're wrong, try to sort of beat them over the head with statistics, that's not going to work. What you have to do is you have to just put your version of the thing on the table. Here's what I think. Take it or leave it. Invite them to take it. If they don't, that's fine. You move on to the next person. Because there's like, you can never win everyone over. What you can do is present your best case and not be pushy. I would never be pushy about it anyway. And if someone isn't interested, I mean, you have to value yourself. You have to value what you have to offer. It's like because being on the side of the truth is a valuable thing. It's an attractive thing. If you had like a bag of money, $1 million or whatever, €1 million, and you wanted to talk to someone, have a conversation with them and wanted to give them this money and they weren't interested, well, you would move on to the next person. I mean, I hope you get my point. You wouldn't be so desperate to sort of give it away. I mean, we have something very positive to offer. We invite people into this social community and so on, and we shouldn't be so desperate. We shouldn't be so pushy. There's no point in being pushy. So
I think this comes from the insecurity of knowing that the majority don't agree with us. So people think they're almost by asking other people to adopt our beliefs, they're asking for approval of those beliefs. Like, please approve of it. And it's an understandable human thing to do because you feel a bit cut out from the mainstream when you know that most people disagree or would find you would instinctively distance themselves from you. And that's a scary position to be in. And so what you've got to do is get over that and understand, yes, most people instinctively distance themselves from this kind of thing, but that does not mean that we're wrong, and you don't need their approval. And it's up to them. You can put the ideas out there. It's up to them to either accept them and understand, have the self-respect to realize the truth or not.
You see, I mean, I'm not sure I even agree with you that most people don't agree with us.
I was being careful when I said that, because yes, of course, what we're saying is just common sense.
Yeah, my point is that most people aren't comfortable saying in public or even to their close ones that they agree with us. But I do think that most people actually agree with us, because if you look at their actions and how they behave and who they socialize with in their real lives, when they're not posturing and so on, they sort of agree with us. they because it's common sense. What we do is just say. I mean, it's been like a classic. It's a classic thing, It was a slogan of the Sweden Democrats back in the day, that we say what you think or whatever, what you don't dare say, but you actually think. The thing is that where I'm coming from with this is that I just refuse to pretend the way many other people do about these issues. I'm not going to pretend. I'm not going to pretend that I agree with things that I don't agree with. Which a lot of people just pretend because they know that's what they're going to get rewarded for. So I think it's very important to realize that a lot of people agree with us, even though they don't say so. And that is another very important thing. Yeah.
Now, earlier on, we were talking about basically optics, and somebody commented, and I want to put this to you.
Right.
Sometimes you need to tell the truth and not care how extreme it sounds or its social implications or the social implications of telling this truth. Sometimes people need to hear things a little bit too truthful that worries them. What would you say to that?
Yes. Yes, I agree that you should tell the truth and even about very controversial things. But a lot of people have misconceptions about what is radical and so on. And they think that in order to be radical and say something radical, you have to behave in a very unattractive way. And that was one of the things that I talked about in those conferences that I referred to in Manchester and in Sweden and so on, with marketing and with the self-image that you project onto others. Because with persuasion, with marketing, with creating a brand, your self-image is going to influence the ideas, even in the implicit ideas that you have in your mind about yourself and how you are going to be perceived by others and how you perceive yourself. Those thoughts and those ideas are going to influence how you influence other people and the image they get of you and how in turn what they internalize and how they are going to behave and so on. And some people confuse having a radical message, and radical in this context means that it radically deviates from what is currently in the mainstream, for example, and behaving in a weird way. Now, one of the things that I said during these conferences is that a lot of people think that in order to be socially acceptable, you have to give up ethno-nationalism and you have to and you have to embrace like civic nationalism, because that's like on a lower level of controversy in a way. So it's not as controversial, that therefore it's going to be more socially accepted and so on. I don't believe that. I think that's completely false. I think what you need to do is you need to stop behaving like you have to stop acting weird. A lot of people who present radical ideas, they could present those radical ideas and those difficult truths in a way that is appealing. What they do instead is that they ghettoize themselves, because they have created a self-identity about being socially rejected, and they are displaying a behavior that is going to confirm that self-image. So what they want to do is they basically have, maybe implicitly, maybe not explicitly, but maybe implicitly in their head, they're basically telling themselves that, well, I'm going to get socially rejected anyway, so I can just say whatever I want. It's like conspiracy theories. Why couldn't I talk about this? Well, why would you present things in a way that's just going to get you socially rejected? Well, in a lot of cases, because that's your self-identity. I know a lot of people who have been involved in this thing for a long time, and their self-identity is as victims. They see themselves as victim, and their behavior is going to confirm that. So they are going to continue remaining in this ghetto, in this intellectual ghetto, if that expression makes any sense, because they don't want to be a part of the normal mainstream. And that's, I mean, there's just so much to say about this. But
and there's so much I could say about it. You know, believe me, I feel your frustration. I share it because I've seen so much of this. It's people who bask in being outsiders. But more than that, people who bask in being rejected by the normies, by the mainstream, and almost tempt it to happen again and again and again by presenting themselves in a way that is simply awful. I mean, I could come up with so many examples of it, but I don't need to. I think everyone knows the kind of thing that I'm talking about. It sometimes staggers me when we could choose to present ourselves well, but we chose instead to present ourselves badly, and then we're surprised, or pretend to be surprised when it goes badly.
Pretend to be surprised.
But in fact, we want it to go badly because we enjoy teasing people, taunting people who have already rejected us as we see it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a form of defeatism, and it's a form of self-pity, and you're such a victim, and you're gonna sort of tell yourself a story about, oh, look, I was just telling people what I believe, and now they rejected me again. I'm such a
victim. I can't get a job.
I can't hold a job because I'm just going to get fired. There's no point in applying for it. I know so many people. I've encountered so many people who think that it's impossible to have a normal job. There are people who get fired for being nationalists, but far from everyone. And oftentimes, many of the things are sort of, things that you can influence in a positive direction if you wanted to, but some people just choose the victim, the sort of self-image, and they choose to be a part of a marginalized. They choose an aesthetic, they choose a mode of presentation that is going to get them marginalized, and that is not going to help them win in any way, because maybe deep down inside they don't want to win. Because there's. There's a lot of things about psychoanalysis that is bullshit. But one of the things that I actually think has a lot of credibility is the idea of a self-image and then defense mechanisms that you have defense mechanisms for defending that image of yourself, the sort of ego. And if you have an image of being a loser and being getting pleasure from being that, there's sort of a masochistic pleasure from being that. You're just going to continue that, and a lot of people, they get associated with these political organizations or something that sort of more or less function as cults, and that is why I hate the often used phrase movement, or the word movement, that this is a movement that does this and that. Well, the movement, I think Michael Walker, who was one of the people who introduced a new right to the English speaking world in the 80s, he once pointed out this in an interview at Countercurrents. I think it was an interview with John Morgan. He said that, I'm not a part of a movement. I don't want to be a part of a movement, because the whole idea of a movement is that this thing is in a ghetto and you're a part of this ghetto and you can be in or out. I'm just having these ideas and I want to put them out there and I want to influence other people in society that I'm a part of. And so it's a different place to be coming from. And, how are you going to be more productive in influencing people? Well, I think by not thinking that who is a part of the movement, who is not a part of the movement. I would
agree and disagree. I think that a movement our enemies work as a movement, they have corporations, organizations that are constantly working, helping each other in order to get things done. But as you say, they also interact constantly, not just every day, but every hour, every minute with the mainstream.
Sure.
Because that's how they spread it.
I mean, there's always, when you talk about these things, and I think that's also another mechanism of being successful or not, is sometimes being able to hold different and often contradictory ideas in your mind at the same time, that on different levels, different truths may be opposed to each other. So on one level, they know that they're a part of something, they have a project. They know who's in, who's out, who's like neutral. On another level, when they communicate to the public, they definitely don't talk about themselves or think about themselves as who's in, who's out, who's a part of this sort of vanguard or not. You have to communicate in a way that's seductive, and it's not seductive you don't want to invite people to be a part of a socially rejected, marginalized, ghettoized group. That's not a positive seductive thing to invite people to become a part of. You have to understand that the way you present things is going to influence what kind of people you're going to attract. And a lot of times, the way people on our side have presented things have that their own work, their own way of communicating has just attracted people who don't want to win because they want to be a part of this marginalized group. That's their self-identity.
Yes. And I think some of them don't really want to win because they don't feel they don't feel, I mean, they're in the mindset of losers. They're in the mindset of people who are oppressed. And really, in that mindset, you can't think of what you would do if you won. You can't think of what you would do if you ran society. So you're not thinking of it, but what you are thinking of is your oppression. And so when you, when such people try to articulate nationalism, let's say, to normal people, what they're actually doing is trying to repeat the rejection again, like get these people to reject me again. And then that just proves how right I am.
Yeah.
So it's a very self-defeating mindset.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that, one of the things that I try to talk about and I try to communicate is that these implicit thoughts, you might not be aware of them, but these implicit things, these things that sort of is like a program running in the back of your mind, sort of behind everything else, influencing everything that is in your conscious mind, but it's going to influence how you communicate what you, and those things have to do with self-image. How do you perceive yourself? What reactions do you expect from other people? I've talked about normalization a lot because it's like, if you define what does it mean, I mean, literally, what does it mean? What would it entail for us to win? What does it mean? I mean, if it was say that, you know, nationalists win, we win our quote unquote movement, if we're going to use that word or not, what would it mean? Well, it means, in my mind at least, it means that our ideas become the new norm. And a lot of people communicate in a way that they don't want them to become the new norm because they want to be radical. And
it's not realistic. You know, the thing is, you can change the world don't in a gradual fashion. It doesn't need to be all at once. And it doesn't need to be a dreadful change. And I think that some people, there tends to be an all or nothing mindset. I was talking about it with somebody else last night or the night before, where there tends to be an all or nothing mindset. If someone doesn't agree with you 100% and the world isn't exactly as you want it, then there is no success. Like, Brexit isn't a success. Boris Johnson isn't a success. Trump isn't a success. Now, of course, we can say we can make massive legitimate criticisms about Boris Johnson, about Donald Trump, but you have to admit that on the whole, it is better than having Hillary Clinton in power, because if nothing else, just because it holds back the left slightly. But yeah, those are examples. I don't want to get caught up in the details of those particular examples. The point is that I think we have to accept things are going to be gradual. Progress is going to be gradual, but that does not mean that it's going to be non-existent.
Hmm. Absolutely, yeah. And it's I don't agree 100% with basically anyone I hang out with. That's not what normal people do. Normal people aren't just copies of each other agreeing about everything. The thing is that having normal conversations with people without being in the intellectual ghetto, that is what this is about. We need to just become a part of the normal, natural discourse in society. And it's about normalizing our, you know, not normalizing our message or normalizing, you know, what we're about in the way that we change in order to adapt to society in that way. It's just that our views become the new norm. That must be the goal. That must be the goal. And that sort of bleeds into another thing that has been relevant at actually my latest conference in Oslo. And that was a thing that Helmut Nyborg, who is a emeritus professor of psychology, talked about controversialization, which is basically the things that he researched during his career, that other researchers have tried to controversialize them, meaning that they portray those ideas and those research results as controversial. This is a controversial person, and these ideas are controversial. And then the people representing those or who have done that research, then they sort of, they accept the role of being controversial. And that's, you know, there's no leftist, French leftist intellectual called Guy Debord, who talked about the society of the spectacle. I forget the title of the book right now, on top of my head, but it was very influential in the 68 left. And what he talked about is like society is like a theater in a way. People play their roles. People have their certain parts that they're supposed to play in a way. Because there's a grand narrative. This is very important on the left, you know, and the postmodernists and so on. There's a narrative about society, what happens and who does what and what groups do what and so on. And part of this narrative is that all those people are controversial. And then some researchers, they internalize this villain image of themselves that their enemies have portrayed of them, that their enemies want to portray them as villains. And then they internalize this and, oh, I'm a controversial person. I'm going to, you know, I happen to be controversial. And that self-image, that influences everything you say and everything you do. It makes you less convincing. It just, one of the things that I've said for many, many years is that, some people talk about nationalism as it's like a dirty joke, you know. It's like you sort of whisper a bit about it. And have you heard this? You have to become relaxed about the subject and not talk about it as this is a radical thing and this is a very controversial thing that I am going to tell you right now. This is a very controversial thing, and maybe you'll accept some part of it.
I think it is often the thing, the case where if you say something that is outrageous, that is unusual. If you say it in a calm, normal way, you know, the person might be surprised. They might be a bit taken aback, but you know, they might well just say, "Oh yeah, that actually is true."
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. And that's a thing that I also repeat, because you know, I have some of my talking points that I often repeat. You know, some of the things that I think are very important. And one of the things that are very important is the sort of the label of extremism. And when they try to call us extremists, we shouldn't accept that, and we shouldn't internalize that as a self-image, because we are not extreme. It's like the left is extreme, and the sort of the mainstream mass media today is extreme, because it so completely deviates from what normal people think and behave, how they behave and what they talk about and think about in their normal lives, that it has nothing to do with reality anymore. What I usually say is that, you know, an average, well, in Sweden or Scandinavia, it would be like a social democratic voter. Social democracy is like the most mainstream thing. This is like the whole center block of politics have been for decades, and an average social democratic voter in the 80s or 90s would agree with 99% of whatever you or I talk about it, where we suggest, and that is how far the political spectrum has drifted. And the people who have a public voice in this, in the mainstream society, they are so extreme that it so deviates from what every normal person thinks about or talks about, that it's unrecognizable in many ways. I've often said that, you know, if Karl Marx was alive today, he would be considered a Nazi. That's how far the political spectrum has drifted.
At least in some ways, he would certainly be considered.
Yeah, Nazi. I mean, because every communist back then, the things they took for granted can no longer be taken for granted, because everything has been demolished and deconstructed. So that you're not allowed to believe anything about normal people.
Really. Yeah. I mean, I think it's very obvious that George Orwell, for example, would be one of us. I don't see any reason why he would not be one of us. The thing is that everyone tries to claim George Orwell, I mean, the left do as well, but they espouse things that he was even mocking then. Feminism, veganism, and God only knows what he would have thought of trans and gay and so on. That I cannot see. No, he was ultimately a conservative, a social conservative. So yeah, but anyway, that's a tangent. So what should we move on to at this point? We've only got half an hour left. So because I read ISAR due on it at that time. So. All right. Would you like to say anything about this decade?
Sure. Let me just say a couple of very brief things about the other conferences. So I talked about up until two conferences in Sweden. And then I had one conference in Copenhagen, where you also were, and where people were attacked by the Antifa. That was also an example of anarcho-tyranny, because And this is one of the victories in which we brought up a thing to people's consciousness in a way. The people who followed our thing, and this is a thing that I repeated, and I think that's very important. And that's saying that the Antifa is a terrorist organization, it's a terrorist movement, because the rules of engagement in liberal democracy is that you present your arguments, you participate in the political debate, and you have to defeat another person in the political debate. If you use violence to try to silence someone, you are by definition a terrorist. Terrorism is the use of violence or the threat of violence to intimidate other people, to shut them up, to try to intimidate them from uttering their opinions in politics.
And that's what they do. See, what staggers me about the left, and I mean the far left, the progressives, the communists, for want of a better word, what staggers me is how presumptuous they are. They see themselves as entitled to interfere with our events and to try to get our events cancelled. I think that we are far more tame. We don't assume that we own the culture, that we own society, and that we can therefore dictate who does and doesn't get to have conferences, and who does and doesn't get to speak at conferences, and who does and doesn't get to enter our countries. But the left do. This really gives the lie to their whole thing about being the underdog. It's laughable.
The thing is that you know what I want to convey with this is that we, you know, nationalists, we accept the liberal democratic rules of engagement. I mean, I am definitely critical of democracy, for example, as a theory of how society is governed, because I don't think that's, and a description of reality, we don't have a democracy. Democracy has never existed, and it's never going to exist, because that's not how society works, and that's not how people work. But as the rules of engagement with an open society, as, you know, Karl Popper, for example, described it, that society should be open to criticism, and we present our criticism, and so on, and if society tries to silence us, then it's totalitarian. That if you're not allowed to criticize the ruling class or the ideas of the ruling class, it's by definition totalitarian. That's what it means to be an open society. It's open to criticism. And if it's not, it's totalitarian. And basically what we need to do is we need to assert our will and assert our rights and demand our rights. Because the thing is that we go out of our way to follow the liberal democratic rules of engagement. Just imagine all the acrobatics we have to do to be able to have a channel on YouTube and so on. We are extremists at following the rules because we have to, because the searchlight is on us. Whereas the left does never follow the rules of engagement in liberal democracy, and we need to hold them accountable for that. We need to get them thrown in jail. We need to get them labeled and treated as terrorists for trying to use physical force to silence us. That's what they try to do, and that's how they should be treated, and that's how that's the things we need to demand by society. If we are going to take the liberal democratic states seriously as described, then they need to enforce that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that you said to me in a private conversation once, that it was a very interesting point, was that people on our side often assume that no one in bureaucracy or in the local councils or whatever can be reasoned with, that they're just not on our side. But actually, well, you take it from there.
Yeah, definitely. That takes us to actually the last conference I had this year, which was in Oslo, where Greg Johnson was arrested. And he was, I mean, there's a, I'm writing a long essay about this, what happened, and what happened with, basically the Norwegian state has said through its police college and through its security service that it's going to police thought. It's going to arrest people or use police resources to preemptively work to prevent the nationalism from growing, identitarianism. He uses a lot of different terms. Anyway, I'm going to explain that in details in a long article. But yeah, they have stated openly that the security service and the police is going to work proactively to prevent nationalists from getting a foothold in the country. So it's admitted that it's broken its own rules of engagement as a liberal democracy. It's going to have a political thought police and for only ideological reasons. Anyhow, what happened was that Greg Johnson was accused of supporting terrorism and he was arrested for that, which was completely ridiculous because at his previous speech at a Skanza forum, we were having a conference on the 2nd of November in Oslo, and a leftist thought watchdog group, sort of like HopeNet Hate or ADL or something, like a small blog, they published an article claiming that Greg Johnson supported Breivik, which is completely ridiculous, and that he supports terrorism, suggesting that he supports terrorism and that he is a threat to the national security of the country and that he should be prevented from entering the country. On his previous speech at the Skanza Forum, the speech was titled Against Right-Wing Terrorism, he said things like, we should hate Brenton Tarrant for what he did, the shooter in New Zealand and so on. So he is very, he's like written a dozen articles against political violence, political right-wing violence, mind you. So that was completely ridiculous. So they tried to create this narrative. And yeah, the security service followed suit. But what we did, we just listed these things. This is obviously false accusations. You have arrested him on false accusations. And this is completely unacceptable. We talked to his lawyer and we just were upfront about this because we follow the rules of engagement in a liberal democracy. The left does not. And they lie about us to try to get a man arrested on false charges. That's illegal. That should be illegal and it should be treated as illegal. And I believe that, yeah, a lot of people, some people in the educational system in the university, in the college, and some people in the security service try to use police resources and use the state for their political ends, to silence political opponents. But then again, there are a lot of, they can't just do whatever they want because there are a lot of people in the system who believe in the system. And if you just give up before and now there's no point in communicating with them, then you've already lost before there's even there's any tension or conflict or anything. And now there was a conflict and we said, this is completely wrong. And I think they came to their senses, or at least, you know, that it became so blatantly obvious that this was a false arrest, that Greg Johnson was arrested on false charges, because we presented the evidence to the contrary of, you know, all these accusations against him, that they had to back down. I mean, they have to adapt. It's like, and that's one of the other things about, the media situation with our own channels and so on, that when the mass media presented an image that they just quoted from this left-wing extremist group, then what people could do was just, well, go to the source. What did he actually say? And they could go to our YouTube channel and look at our comment about it and, you know, where we completely reject all this. And they could see that all these accusations are false. They can see it with their own eyes, and seeing is believing. So that's very effective. And what happened, I mean, it's still up in the air, but what happened is that Greg Johnson is not banned from Norway. They backed down from the charges that he was arrested. He wasn't even arrested anymore. And I mean, I find it very hard to believe that that's not connected to the fact that we were able to push those accusations back by presenting facts and by the fact that the people who are possibly corrupt within the system and who want to use the system for their own political ends, they have to adapt to their colleagues. They have to adapt to other people in the system. They have to keep a straight face, and they have to be able to look each other in the eyes and keep their jobs and so on. So, yeah, we should definitely push our interests and just, you know, state the obvious. We follow the rules. Those people don't follow the rules. Arrest those people. Don't arrest us because, I mean, we have... Because the searchlight has been so hard upon us for decades, we have become very good at following the rules. We definitely make sure that we follow the rules. And therefore, you know, it's we should start demanding answers, and we should start demanding equal treatment from across the political spectrum. That the left shouldn't be allowed, the Antifa, who attack, you know, if they try to frame us as some sort of extremist radical violence group, well, we are the ones being attacked by the violent left trying to silence us. We don't. I've never tried to silence anyone. I don't want to silence anyone. If there's anything I want, it's more debate. I want these issues to be debated more, and I would invite anyone to take me on in that debate. And I don't really care. But they try to actively silence us through political force or through physical force, and that's not acceptable. So we should engage in the system and use the system and demand. You know, that's what the police should do. Police should arrest people who are engaged in criminal behavior, violent criminal behavior. They should arrest the leftists. And I have to say, to their credit, that the police in Oslo on 2nd of November did arrest 28 Antifa people and fined them. So they got heavy fines. And the last thing I heard was that they trying to put on a concert to collect money to pay the debts, because they did illegal things. They tried to attack people having a private peaceful political meeting, and that's not a legal thing to do. So they were arrested, as they should be, and they were fined, and they should be fined more because they did even more illegal things. But I guess that's. That's the second part of the story that's going to come next year, I guess.
Mm. Do you think it's possible for us to be more organized in order to interact with the authorities in a more professional way?
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that I've talked about a lot. And that's, you know, the need for our own legal organizations, like a white ADL. I mean, that's the term that's thrown around, I guess. Because, yes, when... white persons' legal rights are violated, and as a non-self-hating white person that is a nationalist, when his legal rights are violated, he doesn't know where to turn, you know, where to get help to get his rights looked after, and get what he is supposed to get in the society. So we need to get that going, and I've had these conversations. People have so low opinions of themselves. A lot of people said, no, that's not possible. That's completely impossible. That's ridiculous. That's a ridiculous suggestion that it would be impossible for us to get an organization going with lawyers looking out for our interests. You know, there was a time when our people wasn't ashamed to attempt to travel to the moon and leave the planet, you know, develop new technology, gather all the resources, gather the brave people, get them on a rocket and shoot them up into space to leave the planet. And now it's like, can we get a few lawyers together to look after our interests and, you know, look through cases where white people have been attacked illegally and so on? And I'm like, no, that's impossible. With a mindset like that, we're not going to win, and without organizations like that, we're not going to win. So that should be one of the very first things on our agenda. Because if other people can attack us with impunity, and it's like, you know, like we talked about earlier, that, you know, it's not rational, our arguments, that's going to win the day for us. A lot of things are just. Are just conditioning, you know, like punishments and rewards, some of the right now, like all the punishments are on the other side, that they can attack us, through legal means, through lawfare and so on, but we have no way of either defending ourselves or attacking them back. Then the end result is given, because all the pressure is on one side, and we just. You know, giving arguments in our situation is basically just complaining. We can complain about our situation. That's not complaining. Yeah,
I agree. I think that we need to get. I'm convinced that we need to get more organized and more professional in all of this stuff, because it's too easy for the opposition to interfere. And I wouldn't say to ruin our events, although on occasion they certainly have done that. But it's too easy for them to get in the way. And I think that we shouldn't be tolerating that. But in order, see, that's the thing. It's a psychological thing as much as it's a strategic matter. Psychologically, we have to assume we do have the right to have these conferences. We do have the right to social, to gather, to freedom of association. We do have these rights. We're not doing something really naughty and evil and illegal. We are completely in the right doing this, and the moral right, that is. And so they are the ones who are being outrageous in trying. I mean, you can understand why they're doing it. It's strategic from their point of view, but they should not have the right, and they should not have the ability to do this stuff. And I think we have to sort of assume that agency and that moral right to do these things, instead of complaining and hoping for the best and saying, oh God, we're so oppressed and the mainstream aren't on our side. Look, we have to simply to interact with the mainstream and persuade and force them to see, no, you're not going to just dismiss us because we're right wingers or whatever. This is your job to protect our rights.
And I would never do something that ridiculous as something as ridiculous as complaining about my political opponent doing what's effective. Of course they're doing what's effective. We should be ashamed that we're not doing what's effective. That's the way I see it. I mean, complaining that, you know, either you know, the left or other people whose names echo do things that are politically effective to defend their group interests. Of course they do that.
Yes, and we, instead of being outraged by that, we should be doing exactly the same thing.
Yes, we should learn. We should learn. We shouldn't just, oh, why do they do this? Of course we should do the same thing.
Yeah, we indeed. So you wanted to talk about why JF, just to change the subject completely, you wanted to talk about why you thought that JF went too far with the black pilling the other night. So why don't you, to sort of round this off, give us some... what your perspective on that?
Yeah. I mean, I've listened to a couple of the other shows. I didn't hear all of JF's thing, but I heard the first part, I think, and he talked a bit about how we're losing. I don't know if he means from, you know, his perspective, as I think he's a libertarian or something. I have to say, and I'm a huge fan of JF's. I love his channel. I love his work. But I have to say that he's completely wrong about this. We are supposedly losing, that our side is supposedly losing, the right wing. And I think the reason is that he comes at it from a too limited perspective, a too limited time frame. I mean, if you look at the expansion rate of the right from like 2015 or 2016 and all the boom we had, that's not a realistic starting point, because that's a complete anomaly. The thing is that it's like a company 1 year experiencing like 1,000% growth, and then the next year it goes down to 200% growth, and you think, oh, it's all lost. It's all gone to hell now because we don't have 1,000% growth anymore. If you look at it from like a 20-year perspective, we have completely changed the scene. I mean, there's no comparison. For example, the Sweden Democrats, I'll just give an example from Sweden. And the Sweden Democrats were formed in the late 80s. And nationalists, since the Second World War, basically, have for decades and decades and decades just been treated as a pariah movement. You're completely outside of polite society. And it's completely unacceptable to voice any opinions in that direction. And the Sweden Democrats were formed in the late 80s, and they were treated all the time as a very marginalized group. It's completely, something that no intelligent person could be a part of. It's a very smeared group and political party, basically like David Duke in America, for listeners who are not familiar with Swedish circumstances. And for a long time they were a microscopic party, and I don't think they are the saviors or anything like that. I don't think it's a ridiculous party in many ways, but it's a barometer, it's a measurement of public consciousness about some issues. And in 2010, they got around 6% of the vote, I think, and they got into parliament. Swedish parliament, when you have 4%, you get into parliament, 4% of the votes instead of, you know, for example, in America, where you have like the winner takes it all in a way. So you just have a two-party system. In Sweden, you have several parties because you only need a few percent to get into parliament and to get to be able to participate in public debate. And when they got in 2010, that changed a lot of things about what was socially acceptable to talk about in Sweden. And I just heard, well, it was just in the news now, a couple of weeks ago, I think, that Sweden Democrats are now the biggest party in Sweden, according to the latest polls, with 24% of the vote. This is not in an election, but in the latest polls. And that's a game changer. Going from like a marginalized thing that, even though they are not like ethno-nationalists in any way, they are represented as such in the media. That's how they are portrayed. And the way things have developed over these decades, the way things have moved in our direction, and also the left. There was a time when the left was very impressive, but today's left. I mean, if we have like in the 70s and the 80s, a lot of the left was very energetic, very intelligent, and they dominated the debate, and conservatives sort of tried to keep up. They didn't have any initiative really with our types.
Yes, I've made this point myself in several speeches this year, which are yet to be uploaded on my channel, by the way, but they will be, where I said that in the 90s, when I was a kid, it was the right in a debate between a left winger and a right winger. It was always the left winger who had the upper hand, who had the arguments, who seemed cool, and who was still a bit rebellious. And it was the right winger who was the establishment, who had no idea what real life was like, who didn't have any arguments, and who often seemed even like a bad person, like close-minded, stupid, ignorant, and so on. So the left looked cool and functioned well at that point. But now the left-wing intellectual on TV is in a position where, if it was an honest debate, they would have to be defending Rotherham. Yeah, they would have to be defending Cologne. They would have to be defending the migrant crisis. They would have to be defending the Swedish music festivals and where girls are being molested and all the rest of it. They would have to defend stripping the third world or the developing world of its most intelligent people, bringing them over here. They'd have to defend Drag Queen Story Hour. So this is why you can't... That's what they would have to defend if they were going to have an honest debate. And so they can't have an honest debate. The most you can have is some awful, cucked, Sivnat conservative who is so weak that he can't even argue against Drag Queen Story Hour, and that's that's what they'll put the leftist intellectual up against today. More likely they won't even discuss that matter or any of the matters that I just listed.
I mean, it's compare the time when Noam Chomsky was young and he participated in political debates and he just mopped the floor with a lot of the conservative opposition because he was very intelligent, he was very sort of energetic and so on. Have you seen this video with the Royal Majesty, this sort of person in a wheelchair, a black transvestite? They're sort of in, I don't know what it is, like it's like a courtroom or something where they're demanding people to follow the rules about pronouns. It's like transgender people.
I haven't seen this. No.
They're like drooling. They're basically handicapped. That's the kind of left we have left, And basically I've used this example. It's like sometimes they suggest that wealth goes for like three generations or something. Like one person builds all the wealth, and his son sort of maintains it somehow, and the third generation, the grandson, just squanders it all, and he just loses it all and dies basically as a loser. And today's left is basically the retarded sort of useless son of a thrifty and prudent father who sort of built credibility and power, and they've just squandered it, and they're heading straight to the gutter.
Well, this is the thing. Their ideas have now run in society. Yeah. to such an extent that it's become indefensible. Their ideas are now indefensible because we've seen the results of those ideas. So, and often the ideas themselves are now so extreme that you know, like, no such thing as male and female, that kind of thing. They can't defend them. So they have to, all they can do is avoid the debate. How did we get onto this topic about?
Well, you asked me about JFs, my basic point is that I think that JF comes at this. I mean, I guess that he has been, well, as far as I know, it's just the last couple of years, and if you come at it from that time frame that he's been involved in it, involved in the debate for the last couple of years, then yeah, I can see the trajectory going downward. But if you look, from 2015 or 2016 with the traction we have, but if you look at the traction we have compared to 1995 with nationalism, there's no comparison. I mean, we've just skyrocketed with just the traction that nationalism has as a thing and as a you know, the status it has and among people and young people, young intelligent people, and so on. So things are moving in our direction. I mean, the left has basically already won, already lost. They're destroyed, and YouTube tries to censor us. Why? Well, why did YouTube allow us to begin with? I think it's because they thought that, well, these people can just have their free speech because they're not going to have any influence. Now they're saying, holy shit, these people are actually influential and very intelligent, and they're getting a lot of people. Maybe we should shut them up. So I think that's why they're trying to silence us, because we're effective and very successful. So I don't agree with his description of the sort of bleak future of nationalism. Maybe he was just rhetorical. I don't know, but
or maybe he was having a bad night or something. I don't know.
I mean, I like the guy. I love his work, but I definitely don't, because if you just look at the numbers, you know, we have national populist things popping up in, you know, Germany, France.
All of that. But I think what really gives me hope is to see the dreadful state of the left today. Yeah. I mean, they're just in an utter mess. And it's not just because of this recent general election in Britain, which resulted in, you know, leftist intellectuals.
It's a sort of an oxymoron, right?
That's a good point in itself, though. That's a good point in itself, that their idea of an intellectual is Owen Jones or Laurie Penny or Ash Sarkar, who are numbskulls. If that's what the left now has as intellectual, that itself is a bad sign. But anyway, I'm not just talking about those awful the state that they're in now because of this general election. I mean, in general, their ideas are now indefensible, and yet what they do, what the left does as a sort of organism, is it tries to stifle debate. Now that, I think, is, it's just so obvious and so undeniable, and it's so desperate. And why are they doing this? Because they can't answer the points at a massive scale. The entire left cannot answer any of the many thousands and thousands of attacks that are being waged against it. So all it can do is try to drown them out and try to censor them. Mm-hmm. Now, the point, of course, people will say, but it does have the power to censor at that scale. Yes, it does. But the problem continues, though. It just goes on and on. And eventually, yes, I think it will collapse under its own weight and under its own absurdity. We're already starting to see that with the left eating itself and eating even some of its luminaries like J.K. Rowling and so forth. It's basically, they've become so detached from normal life, they can only now implode and slowly crumble. So I think that the challenge, someone said earlier that they're going down, but they want to take everyone else down with them. That's true. But I also think that the challenge now is to be in a position and in a condition whereby we can intervene in the chaos, the disarray that will emerge from the leftist implosion.
Yes. This is what I said in a speech in the Netherlands. I guess it's a couple of years ago now, or at least 1 year ago. That you know, these measures are not from a position of strength. It's from a position of desperation. It's basically like in Starship Troopers, you know, the big brain, it's afraid, you know. That's why they do this, because they're afraid and they know they're losing. So it's like a hysteria. And I think, you know, that what we'll see more and more is the clever people on the other side of the political spectrum will try to reach out, you know, a hand of reconciliation and try to salvage whatever they can, because they understand that they're a part of a losing trajectory, and we are a part of the ascending trajectory. So,
yes,
if you follow the long term patterns over the last decade or last couple of decades, there is no doubt which direction things are moving with you know, the kind of traction that our ideas have. So, of course,
I mean, absolutely. You've only got to look at which side is in touch with human nature and is and with the modern world, is able to analyze and diagnose the modern world.
Yeah.
And which side is living in utter delusion and and trying to enforce clown world upon everyone. It's obvious which one is more tenable, which one has a long-term future. Oh, by the way, we've passed midnight, so Merry Christmas, Frody, and good Yule. Yeah.
Merry Christmas and good Yule to all the Scandinavian listeners. We actually celebrate the 24th in Scandinavia more than in, I guess, British and American listeners will celebrate more on the 25th, I guess.
Well, so. I hope you had a nice day. Yeah. But for all my British Anglospherical listeners, Merry Christmas. It's nice to be able to say it to you. So, okay, I think that's a good point to end on, but let's just quickly rattle through some super chats. Can you kindly ask Mr. Frody Midyard what he requests from his barber? I'm looking for a similar look myself, but I'm not sure how best to articulate what I want.
that's a good one. Well, thank you, first of all, for the question. That's a nice question. I don't really know. I mean, if you have a photo of someone, it's obviously the best thing to bring a photo of the haircut that you want.
Screenshots are pending.
Yes. You have to go into the sort of the more forbidden parts of history to find the perfect examples, I think. Actually, my haircut was just like a barber that I had who did something that I really liked, and I sort of, yeah, we tweaked it more in the right direction, and now I have something that I'm very happy with. So I don't think I tried to emulate anyone or put any sort of specific words on it, but yeah, we reached a good point, I think.
Okay, excellent. Not a question. This is from On the Offensive. I just want to wish you both a blessed Christmas and a happy new year. Keep up the great work you're doing, Frody. God bless.
Thank you. And I just want to add just very briefly that if anyone listens to this and wants like an introduction to who I am or like more of this, we did a very good chat that I'm very happy with and that I've gotten a lot of compliments for, or, you know, a lot of encouraging words about an interview that I did with On the Offensive, that is on his channel. And I very much admire his work, and he's a very talented guy. He's a very impressive guy, and I was very impressed with the speech he gave when I met him in the UK.
Yeah, he's a very good guy. I mean, I hope that he's going to give speeches more regularly in future, because that was a very successful one that he gave. I knew that he would be good at it. It was I will take credit. It was my idea to. I said to Mark that he should invite him, and it paid off. It went very well.
Great, you gave that suggestion.
All right, how to bring back idealism to right-wing youth? Idealism peaked with the 2016 Trump election. Now it seems that it's at its low, and ironic nihilism is dominating.
Yes, that one of the best speeches that has been given at any Scanza forum is a speech given by Greg Johnson in the summer of 2017, when you, Woz, also gave your first speech at a Scanza forum in Oslo. And that was about irony and that kind of mindset, which is toxic. And that's a fantastic speech. It was up on Red Ice. Red Ice isn't there anymore on YouTube. So maybe that speech is available on BitChute. Used to be on the Red Ice YouTube channel because they filmed it and broadcast it. That was fantastic. And yes, I do think irony is a problem. We need idealism. And I think we need to... I mean, it's a double-edged sword because irony is a problem. Irony is a problem in society. But idealism and actually positive visions of the future, that's our edge. You know, that's the only... we are the only people offering that. So I think that's that's the thing. That's the unique thing that we have to offer that people are desperate to get. And that's why we will get more and more people to our side. And I think that idealism and a meaningful life and a movement away from irony and nihilism, it comes from realizing that you're a part of a chain. So realizing that you have roots, it's a big complex issue. And I know we're running late. So, I gave a speech about this last year, 1 year ago, called The Metaphysics, Paganism as Metaphysics, I think I called the speech. It's about, it's a very philosophical speech, but it's very much about the fundamentals, the philosophical fundamentals of what I believe in. And I think it's being rooted and realizing that you're not an atomized individual, that you're a part of, that you're born into a role of, in a historical context, in a social context, and you're born into conflict, you're born into a family, you're born into all kinds of things with a place, with biology, with culture, all kinds of things. And those are the things that give you value and give you meaning in life. And the project of liberalism to try to portray people as blank slates, tabula rasa, that is what leads to nihilism, and that's the downfall of liberalism as well, because that is really what kills it, and because it kills the people psychologically, spiritually, who are a part of liberalism. And that's why we are the only people who have a way out of that for a meaningful life, and that is to be a part of who you actually are, who you were born as, and to cultivate that.
Yes. Yeah, and someone has said nihilism is low T, right-wing idealism is high T. I think that's probably true.
I think so, yes. I think, just to give a very trivial example, I mean, you can be very sort of depressed and you can go to the gym and lift weights and you'll immediately feel better because you're in your body again. You're in your masculine energy in your body, and you're not up in your head just worrying about bullshit, worrying about the past, worrying about the future, you know, all kinds of things like that. You're in your body, and it's a masculine thing. I definitely agree that there's probably something in that direction.
Yes. Okay. I mean, I'm not going to go into that because it relates to a very big topic that I'm going to be discussing throughout next year in a series called Regeneration. So I'm not going to hog the limelight just now.
I think the golden one would agree.
Okay. Someone says, I do think JF goes too far with his black pills, but it seems that Frode's critique of his stance is naive. How will you reverse demographics? The heart of JF's argument is that it won't be reversed.
Well, I'm talking about, I don't think democracy is a reality. I don't think that it's... Just to give an example that I hope doesn't break the rules, Jews in America, for example, or Jews in the West, have never had a voting majority. There has never been a voting majority in a European country where, you know, the voting majority was Jewish. There have been a couple of percent, but they have still been very much able to influence policy in their direction and toward their interests. So I don't think that the... You know, when we pass the 50% line, when we get below that, then all is lost. I don't believe that. I think that's nonsense. I think the trajectory of a political will to power and a political consciousness, that's what determines where we're going, not the demographic changes. Definitely it's important, but it's not the end, the end of everything. How many percent of India were British when the British were...
It was tiny. It was unbelievable. I can't remember the number now, but I think it was it it was in the tens of thousands in a country of many, many millions. So
I think it's ridiculous to suggest that we can't look out for our interests and create a brilliant future, although, you know, we end up being below 50% of the population for a brief period of time before we take back control. I don't think that's what determines our destiny.
Yeah, I agree. It's a matter of will, not numbers. We've got the ability. We just need to have the will to use it and to intelligently work our way out of this situation.
But I've never seen the other as in other races as sort of the major opponent. I've just seen stupidity among our own people as the major opponent that we have to overcome. When we have our own people on our side, we can do anything.
Yes, indeed. What a nice optimistic statement. But I think you're absolutely right. Okay. After hopefully solving the woman question, the JQ, liberal and immigrant and religious issues, might the egos and sectarianism that currently divide the right still remain and potentially be our downfall when we get power?
No, definitely not. I've talked so much about this. The reason we get socially... Well, let's put it like this. When you have a political movement that is marginalized and you get socially punished for being a part of that movement, that will automatically have a vast overrepresentation of certain personality types that aren't mainstream. You will have things like, ironically, you will have homosexuals, because homosexuals are already outsiders, so they don't have as much social acceptability to lose, because they're already outsiders, no matter how much the modern politically correct society pretends that they are not outsiders. They are. And that's why we would have an overrepresentation of them, although we wouldn't expect that considering, you know, conservatism and all that. We would have an overrepresentation of, you know, Asperger's, people with Asperger's, intelligent people, but people who aren't very sensitive to social ostracism. To being pushed out of society, because they're not sensitive, they don't notice it, they don't feel it as much as other people. And that's why we have an underrepresentation of women, because women are more socially sensitive to social pressure, and that's why they feel it more, and they're more sensitive to it, and they feel the pain more of being pushed out of society. That's why they're afraid of being a part of these kinds of things. And we will also have sociopaths who enjoy being hated. They will also be overrepresented, because they enjoy they enjoy being vilified. They enjoy the conflicts. It's an end in itself. When we win more and more, those people might still be there, but they will no longer be very overrepresented. We will have, the more our thing becomes normalized, the more the people we have will be normalized, because we will be able to attract more normalized people. It will not be an eternal problem.
Yeah, that's what's happened already in the course of, you know, the last 10, 15 years. So it's that, because of our numbers growing. So as our numbers continue to grow, the same process will continue.
Yes.
Thank God, because God knows these types are enough of an annoyance, even as they as it currently is. No, so, all right. I don't think there are any more questions. So let's leave it at that. Frody, any final thoughts?
Well, I just want to wish everyone a Merry Christmas, God Jul, and thank you for doing this. This is my third time on, and I very much enjoy it, and I hope you're going to continue doing what you do. And you know, I think I've said enough, and you know, if people want to know more about what I'm doing, Scanza Forum, I'm now on Twitter, you can follow me there. You can follow me on all kinds of places. I participate in Couch Currents Radio semi-regularly, sort of once a week, but not always. Guide to Culture is my thing on YouTube about films. It's a smaller thing, but I'm a culture enthusiast, and I think culture is very important about what happens in the future and so on. And I'm going to continue doing physical, real-world meetups, because I think that's where the real change is, not, you know, by just abstract ideas. It's when people meet, they can accomplish things, and that's why it's important to give people a platform to meet. And I'm going to continue doing what I do until my dying breath. And I hope the same goes for everyone listening to this. And so thank you for having me on.
Oh, you're very welcome. You're always one of the most popular guests. And I always enjoy speaking to you because you're so articulate and full of ideas. So thank you very much, Frode Medjord, for appearing on Millennial 2019.
Give my best to Red Eyes as well.
Okay, I'll do that. And so I'll be on in about 10 minutes with Red Ice, Henrik and Lana. In the meantime, that this was Frode Medjord. Thank you to everyone for watching. And I'll see you soon. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.